glucose. High blood sugar, in turn, provokes high blood insulin. Insulin is released by the pancreas in response to the blood sugar. The higher the blood sugar, the more insulin must be released to move the sugar into the body's cells, such as those of the muscle and liver. When the pancreas's ability to produce insulin in response to blood sugar rises is exceeded, diabetes develops. But you don't have to be diabetic to experience high blood sugar and high insulin. Non-diabetics can easily experience the high blood sugars required to cultivate their very own wheat belly, particularly because foods made from wheat so readily convert to sugar. High blood insulin provokes visceral fat accumulation, the body's means of storing excess energy. When visceral fat accumulates, the flood of inflammatory signals it produces causes tissues such as muscle and liver to respond less to insulin. This so-called insulin resistance means that the pancreas must produce greater and greater quantities of insulin to metabolize the sugars. Eventually, a vicious circle of increased insulin resistance, increased insulin production, increased deposition of visceral fat, increased insulin resistance, etc., etc., ensues. Nutritionists established the fact that wheat increases blood sugar more profoundly than table sugar 30 years ago. As we've discussed, the glycemic index, or GI, is the nutritionist's measure of how much blood sugar levels increase in the 90 to 120 minutes after a food is consumed. By this measure, whole wheat bread has a GI of 72, while plain table sugar has a GI of 59, though some labs have gotten results as high as 65. In contrast, kidney beans have a GI of 51, grapefruit comes in at 25, while non-carbohydrate foods such as salmon and walnuts have GIs of essentially zero. Eating these foods has no effect on blood sugar. In fact, with few exceptions, few foods have as high a GI as foods made from wheat. Outside of dried sugar-rich fruits such as dates and figs, the only other foods that have GIs as high as wheat products are dried, pulverized starches such as cornstarch, rice starch, potato starch, and tapioca starch. It is worth noting that these are the very same carbohydrates often used to make gluten-free food. More on this later. Because wheat carbohydrate, the uniquely digestible amylopectin A, causes a greater spike in blood sugar than virtually any other food, more than a candy bar, table sugar, or ice cream, it also triggers greater insulin release. More amylopectin A means higher blood sugar, higher insulin, more visceral fat deposition, bigger wheat belly. Throw in the inevitable drop in blood sugar, hypoglycemia, that is the natural aftermath of high insulin levels, and you see why irresistible hunger so often results, as the body tries to protect you from the dangers of low blood sugar. You scramble for something to eat to increase blood sugar, and the cycle is set in motion again, repeating every 2 hours. Now factor in your brain's response to the euphoric exorphin effects induced by wheat, and the attendant potential for withdrawal if your next fix is missed. And it's no wonder the wheat belly encircling your waist continues to grow and grow. Men's lingerie is on the second floor. Wheat belly is not just a cosmetic issue, but a phenomenon with real health consequences. In addition to producing inflammatory hormones such as leptin, visceral fat is also a factory for estrogen production in both sexes, the very same estrogen that confers female characteristics on girls beginning at puberty, such as widening of the hips and growth of the breasts. Until menopause, adult females have high levels of estrogen. Surplus estrogen, however, produced by visceral fat, adds considerably to breast cancer risk, since estrogen at high levels stimulates breast tissue. Thus, increased visceral fat on a female has been associated with an increased risk for breast cancer, as high as fourfold. Breast cancer risk in postmenopausal women with the visceral fat of a wheat belly is double that of slender, non-wheat belly-bearing postmenopausal females. Despite the apparent connection, no study, incredibly, has examined the results of a wheat-free, lose-the-visceral-fat wheat belly diet and its effect on the incidence of breast cancer. If we simply connect the dots, a marked reduction in risk would be predicted. Males, having only a tiny fraction of the estrogen of females, are sensitive to anything that increases estrogen. The bigger the wheat belly in males, the more estrogen that is produced by visceral fat tissue. Since estrogen stimulates growth of breast tissue, elevated estrogen levels can cause men to develop larger breasts, those dreaded man boobs, man-cans, or, for you professional types, gynecomastia. Levels of the hormone prolactin are also increased as much as sevenfold by visceral fat. As the name suggests, prolactin means stimulating lactation. High prolactin levels stimulate breast tissue growth and milk production. Enlarged breasts on a male are therefore not just the embarrassing body feature that your annoying nephew snickers at, but B-cup evidence that estrogen and prolactin levels are increased due to the inflammatory and hormonal factory hanging around your waist. An entire industry is growing to help men embarrassed by their enlarged breasts. Male breast reduction surgery is booming, growing nationwide at double-digit rates. Other solutions include special clothing, compression vests, and exercise programs. Maybe Seinfeld's Kramer wasn't so crazy when he invented the man's ear. Increased estrogen, breast cancer, man boobs, all from the bag of bagels shared at the office. Celiac disease, a weight loss laboratory. As noted earlier, the one ailment to which wheat has been conclusively linked is celiac disease. Celiac sufferers are counseled to remove wheat products from their diet, lest all manner of nasty complications of their disease develop. What can their experience teach us about the effects of wheat elimination? In fact, there are unclaimed gems of important weight loss lessons to be gleaned from clinical studies of people with celiac disease who remove wheat gluten-containing foods. The lack of appreciation of celiac disease among physicians, coupled with its many unusual presentations, for example, fatigue or migraine headaches without intestinal symptoms, means an average delay of 11 years from symptom onset to diagnosis. Celiac sufferers may therefore develop a severely malnourished state due to impaired nutrient absorption at the time of their diagnosis. This is especially true for children with celiac disease, who are often both underweight and underdeveloped for their age. Some celiac sufferers become positively emaciated before the cause of their illness is determined. A 2010 Columbia University study of 369 people with celiac disease enrolled 64 participants, 17.3%, with an incredible body mass index of 18.5 or less. A BMI of 18.5 in a 5'4" female would equate to a weight of 105 pounds or 132 pounds for a 5'10" male. Years of poor nutrient and calorie absorption, worsened by frequent diarrhea, leave many celiac sufferers underweight, malnourished, and struggling just to maintain weight. Elimination of wheat gluten removes the offensive agent that destroys the intestinal lining. Once the intestinal lining regenerates, better absorption of vitamins, minerals, and calories becomes possible, and weight begins to increase due to improved nutrition. Such studies document the weight gain with wheat removal experienced by underweight, malnourished celiac sufferers. For this reason, celiac disease has traditionally been regarded as a plague of children and emaciated adults. However, celiac experts have observed that over the past 30 to 40 years, newly diagnosed patients with celiac disease are more and more often overweight or obese. One such recent 10-year tabulation of newly diagnosed celiac patients showed that 39% started overweight, BMI 25 to 29.9, and 13% started obese, BMI 30. By this estimate, more than half the people now diagnosed with celiac disease are therefore overweight or obese. If we focus only on overweight people who are not severely malnourished at time of diagnosis, celiac sufferers actually lose a substantial quantity of weight when they eliminate wheat gluten. A Mayo Clinic University of Iowa study tracked 215 celiac patients after wheat gluten elimination and tabulated 27.5 pounds of weight loss in the first 6 months in those who started obese. In the Columbia University study cited, wheat elimination cut the frequency of obesity in half within a year, with more than 50% of the participants with a starting BMI in the overweight range of 25 to 29.9 losing an average of 26 pounds. Dr. Peter Green, lead gastroenterologist in the study and professor of clinical medicine at Columbia, speculates that it is unclear whether it is reduced calories or another factor in diet responsible for the weight loss of the gluten-free diet. With all you've learned, isn't it clear that it's the elimination of wheat that accounts for the extravagant weight loss? Similar observations have been made in children. Kids with celiac disease who eliminate wheat gluten gain muscle and resume normal growth, but also have less fat mass compared to kids without celiac disease. Tracking weight changes in kids is complicated by the fact that they are growing. Another study showed that 50% of obese children with celiac disease approached normal BMI with wheat gluten elimination. What makes this incredible is that beyond gluten removal, the diet in celiac patients is not further restricted. These were not purposeful weight loss programs, just wheat and gluten elimination. No calorie counting was involved, nor portion control, exercise, or any other means of losing weight, just losing the wheat. There are no prescriptions for carbohydrate or fat content, just removal of wheat gluten. It means that some people incorporate gluten-free foods, such as breads, cupcakes, and cookies, that cause weight gain, sometimes dramatic. As we will discuss later, if you have a goal of weight loss, it will be important not to substitute one weight-increasing food, wheat, with yet another collection of weight-increasing foods, gluten-free items. In many gluten-free programs, gluten-free foods are actually encouraged. Despite this flawed diet prescription, the fact remains. Overweight celiac sufferers experience marked weight loss with elimination of wheat gluten. Investigators performing these studies, though suspecting other factors, never offer the possibility that weight loss is from elimination of a food that causes extravagant weight gain, that is, wheat. Interestingly, these patients have substantially lower caloric intake once on a gluten-free diet compared to people not on a gluten-free diet, even though other foods are not restricted. Calorie intake measured 14% less per day on gluten-free diets. Another study found that celiac patients who strictly adhered to gluten elimination consumed 418 calories less per day than celiac patients who were non-compliant and permitted wheat gluten to remain in their diets. For someone whose daily calorie intake is 2,500 calories, this would represent a 16.7% reduction in calorie intake. Guess what that does to weight. Symptomatic of the bias of conventional nutritional dogma, the investigators in the first study labeled the diet followed by participants recovered from celiac disease unbalanced, since the gluten-free diet contained no pasta, bread, or pizza, but included more wrong natural foods. Yes, they actually said this, such as meat, eggs, and cheese. In other words, the investigators proved the value of a wheat-free diet that reduces appetite and requires calorie replacement with real food without intending to or indeed even realizing they had done so. A recent thorough review of celiac disease, for instance, written by two highly regarded celiac disease experts, makes no mention of weight loss with gluten elimination. But it's right there in the data, clear as day. Lose the wheat, lose the weight. Investigators in these studies also tend to dismiss the weight loss that results from wheat-free, gluten-free diets as due to the lack of food variety with wheat elimination, rather than wheat elimination itself. As you will see later, there is no lack of variety with elimination of wheat. There is plenty of great food remaining in a wheat-free lifestyle. It might be the lack of exorphins, reduction of the insulin-glucose cycle that triggers hunger, or some other factor, but elimination of wheat reduces total daily calorie intake by 350 to 400 calories, with no further restrictions on calories, fats, carbohydrates, or portion sizes. No smaller plates, prolonged chewing, or frequent small meals. Just banishing wheat from your table. There's no reason to believe that weight loss with wheat elimination is peculiar to celiac disease sufferers. It's true for people with gluten sensitivity and for people without gluten sensitivity. So when we extrapolate wheat elimination to people who don't have celiac disease, as I have done in thousands of patients, we see the same phenomenon, dramatic and immediate weight loss, similar to that seen in the obese celiac population. Lose the wheat belly. 10 pounds in 14 days. I know, it sounds like another TV infomercial boasting the latest lose weight fast gimmick. But I've seen it time and time again. Eliminate wheat in all its myriad forms, and pounds melt away, often as much as a pound a day. No gimmicks, no subscription meals, no special formulas, no meal replacement drinks or cleansing regimens required. Obviously, weight loss at this rate can be maintained for only so long, or you'd end up a pile of dust. But the initial pace of weight loss can be shocking, equaling what you might achieve with an outright fast. I find this phenomenon fascinating. Why would elimination of wheat yield weight loss as rapid as starvation? I suspect it is a combination of halting the glucose-insulin fat deposition cycle and the natural reduction in calorie intake that results. But I have seen it happen time and time again in my practice. Wheat elimination is often part of low-carbohydrate diets. Clinical studies are accumulating that demonstrate the weight loss advantages of low-carb diets. In fact, the success of low-carb diets, in my experience, originates largely from the elimination of wheat. Cut carbs, and by necessity, you cut wheat. Because wheat dominates the diets of most modern adults, removing wheat removes the biggest problem source. I've also witnessed low-carb diets fail because the only remaining carbohydrate source in the diet was wheat-containing products. Sugar and other carbohydrates do indeed count, too. In other words, if you eliminate wheat but drink sugary sodas and eat candy bars and corn chips every day, you will negate most of the weight loss benefit of eliminating wheat. But most rational adults already know that avoiding Big Gulps and Ben & Jerry's is a necessary part of weight loss. It's the wheat that seems counterintuitive. Wheat elimination is a vastly underappreciated strategy for rapid and profound weight loss, particularly from visceral fat. I've witnessed the wheat belly weight loss effect thousands of times. Eliminate wheat and weight drops rapidly, effortlessly, often as much as 50, 60, 100 or more pounds over a year, depending on the degree of excess weight to start. Just among the last 30 patients who eliminated wheat in my clinic, the average weight loss was 26.7 pounds over 5.6 months. The amazing thing about wheat elimination is that removing this food that triggers appetite and addictive behavior forges a brand new relationship with food. You eat food because you need it to supply your physiologic energy needs, not because you have some odd food ingredient pushing your appetite buttons, increasing appetite and the impulse to eat more and more. You will find yourself barely interested in lunch at noon, easily bypassing the bakery counter at the grocery store, turning down the donuts in the office break room without a blink. You will divorce yourself from the helpless, wheat-driven desire for more and more and more. It makes perfect sense. If you eliminate foods that trigger exaggerated blood sugar and insulin responses, you eliminate the cycle of hunger and momentary satiety. You eliminate the dietary source of addictive exorphins. You are more satisfied with less. Excess weight dissolves, and you revert back to physiologically appropriate weight. You lose the peculiar and unsightly ring around your abdomen. Kiss your wheat belly goodbye. Down 104 pounds, 20 more to go. When I first met Gino, he had that familiar look, gray pallor, tired, almost inattentive. At 5 feet 10, his 322 pounds included a considerable wheat belly flowing over his belt. Gino came to me for an opinion regarding a coronary prevention program triggered by concern over an abnormal heart scan score, an indicator of coronary atherosclerotic plaque and potential risk for heart attack. Not unexpectedly, Gino's girth was accompanied by multiple abnormal metabolic measures, including high blood sugars well into the range defined as diabetes, high triglycerides, low HDL cholesterol, and several others, all contributors to his coronary plaque and heart disease risk. I somehow got through to him, despite his seemingly indifferent demeanor. I believe it helped that I enlisted the assistance of his chief cook and grocery shopper, Gino's wife. He was at first puzzled by the idea of eliminating all healthy whole grains, including his beloved pasta, and replacing them with all the foods that he had regarded as no-nos, such as nuts, oils, eggs, cheese, and meats. 6 months later, Gino came back to my office. I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that he was transformed. Alert, attentive, and smiling, Gino told me that his life had changed. He had not only lost an incredible 64 pounds and 14 inches off his waist in those 6 months, he had regained the energy of his youth, again wanting to socialize with friends and travel with his wife, walking and biking outdoors, sleeping more deeply, along with a newly rediscovered optimism. And he had laboratory values that matched. Blood sugars were in the normal range, HDL cholesterol had doubled, triglycerides dropped from several hundred milligrams to a perfect range. Another 6 months later, Gino had lost 40 more pounds, now tipping the scale at 218, a total of 104 pounds lost in 1 year. My goal is 198 pounds, the weight I had when I got married, Gino told me. Only 20 more pounds to go. And he said it with a smile. Be gluten-free, but don't eat gluten-free. Say what? Gluten is the main protein of wheat, and as I have explained, it is responsible for some, though not all, of the adverse effects of wheat consumption. Gluten is the culprit underlying inflammatory damage to the intestinal tract and celiac disease. People with celiac disease must meticulously avoid food containing gluten. This means the elimination of wheat, as well as gluten-containing grains such as barley, rye, spelt, triticale, kamut, and perhaps oats. People with celiac disease often seek out gluten-free foods that mimic wheat-containing products. An entire industry has developed to meet their gluten-free desires, from gluten-free bread to gluten-free cakes and desserts. However, many gluten-free foods are made by replacing wheat flour with cornstarch, rice starch, potato starch, or tapioca starch, starch extracted from the root of the cassava plant. This is especially hazardous for anybody looking to drop 20, 30, or more pounds, since gluten-free foods, though they do not trigger the immune or neurological response of wheat gluten, still trigger the glucose-insulin response that causes you to gain weight. Wheat products increase blood sugar and insulin more than most other foods, but remember, foods made with cornstarch, rice starch, potato starch, and tapioca starch are among the few foods that increase blood sugar even more than wheat products. So gluten-free foods are not problem-free. Gluten-free foods are the likely explanation for the overweight celiac sufferers who eliminate wheat and fail to lose weight. In my view, there is no role for gluten-free foods beyond the occasional indulgence, since the metabolic effect of these foods is little different from eating a bowl of jelly beans. Thus, wheat elimination is not just about eliminating gluten. Eliminating wheat means eliminating the amylopectin A of wheat, the form of complex carbohydrate that actually increases blood sugar higher than table sugar and candy bars. But you don't want to replace wheat's amylopectin A with the rapidly absorbed carbohydrates of powdered rice starch, corn starch, potato starch, and tapioca starch. In short, don't replace wheat calories with rapidly absorbed carbohydrates of the sort that trigger insulin and visceral fat deposition. And avoid gluten-free foods if you are gluten-free. Later in the book, I will discuss the ins and outs of wheat removal, how to navigate everything from choosing healthy replacement foods to wheat withdrawal. I provide a view from the trenches, having witnessed thousands of people do it successfully. But before we get to the details of wheat elimination, let's talk about celiac disease. Even if you do not suffer from this devastating disease, understanding its causes and cures provides a useful framework for thinking about wheat and its role in the human diet. Beyond teaching us lessons about weight loss, celiac disease can provide other useful health insights to those of us without this condition. So put down that Cinnabon and let's talk about celiac. Chapter 6. Hello, intestine. It's me, wheat. Wheat and celiac disease. Your poor, unsuspecting intestine. There it is, doing its job every day, pushing along the partially digested remains of your last meal through 20-some feet of small intestine, 4 feet of large intestine, eventually yielding the stuff that dominates the conversations of most retired people. It never stops for a rest, but just does its thing, never asking for a raise or health care benefits. Deviled eggs, roast chicken, or spinach salad are all transformed into the familiar product of digestion, the bilirubin-tinted, semi-solid waste that, in our modern society, you just flush away, no questions asked. Enter an intruder that can disrupt the entire happy system, wheat gluten. After Homo sapiens and our immediate predecessors spent millions of years eating from the limited menu of hunting and gathering, wheat entered the human diet, a practice that developed only during the past 10,000 years. This relatively brief time, 300 generations, was insufficient to allow all humans to make the adaptation to this unique plant. The most dramatic evidence of failed adaptation to wheat is celiac disease, the disruption of small intestinal health by wheat gluten. There are other examples of failed adaptation to foods, such as lactose intolerance, but celiac disease stands alone in the severity of the response and its incredibly varied expression. Even if you don't have celiac disease, I urge you to read on. Wheat Belly is not a book about celiac disease, but it is impossible to talk about the effects of wheat on health without talking about celiac disease. Celiac disease is the prototype for wheat intolerance, a standard against which we compare all other forms of wheat intolerance. Celiac disease is also on the rise, increasing fourfold over the past 50 years, a fact that, I believe, reflects the changes that wheat itself has undergone. Not having celiac disease at age 25 does not mean you cannot develop it at age 45, and it is increasingly showing itself in a variety of new ways, besides disruption of intestinal function. So even if you have happy intestinal health and can match success stories of regularity with your grandmother, you can't be sure that some other body system is not being affected in a celiac-like way. Flowery descriptions of the characteristic diarrheal struggles of celiac sufferers started with the ancient Greek physician Aretaeus in AD 100, who advised celiac patients to fast. No lack of theories issued over the ensuing centuries to try to explain why celiac sufferers had intractable diarrhea, cramping, and malnutrition. It led to useless treatments, such as castor oil, frequent enemas, and eating bread only if toasted. There were even treatments that enjoyed some degree of success, including Dr. Samuel Gee's use of the muscle-only diet in the 1880s and Dr. Sidney Haas's 8-bananas-a-day diet. The connection between celiac disease and wheat consumption was first made in 1953 by Dutch pediatrician Dr. Willem Karel Dikke. It was the chance observation of the mother of a celiac child who observed that her son's rash improved when she did not feed him bread that first sparked his suspicion. During food shortages toward the end of World War II, bread became scarce, and Dikke witnessed improvements of celiac symptoms in children, only to witness deterioration when Swedish relief planes dropped bread into the Netherlands. Dr. Dikke subsequently made meticulous measurements of children's growth and stool fat content that finally confirmed that the gluten of wheat, barley, and rye was the source of the life-threatening struggles. Gluten elimination yielded dramatic cures, major improvements over the banana and mussel regimens. While celiac disease is not the most common expression of wheat intolerance, it provides a vivid and dramatic illustration of what wheat is capable of doing when it encounters the unprepared human intestine. Celiac disease. Beware the mighty breadcrumb. Celiac disease is serious stuff. It's truly incredible that a disease so debilitating, potentially fatal, can be triggered by something as small and seemingly innocent as a breadcrumb or a crouton. About 1% of the population is unable to tolerate wheat gluten, even in small quantities. Feed gluten to these people, and the lining of the small intestine, the delicate barrier separating incipient fecal matter from the rest of you, breaks down. It leads to cramping, diarrhea, and yellow-colored stools that float in the toilet bowl because of undigested fats. If this is allowed to progress over years, the celiac sufferer becomes unable to absorb nutrients, loses weight, and develops nutritional deficiencies, such as deficiencies of protein, fatty acids, and vitamins B12, D, E, K, folate, iron, and zinc. The broken-down intestinal lining allows various components of wheat to gain entry to places they don't belong, such as the bloodstream, a phenomenon that is used to diagnose the condition. Antibodies against wheat gliadin, one of the components of gluten, can be found in the blood. It also causes the body to generate antibodies against components of the disrupted intestinal lining itself, such as transglutaminase and endomysium, two proteins of intestinal muscle that also provide the basis for two other antibody tests for diagnosis of celiac, transglutaminase and endomysium antibodies. Otherwise, friendly bacteria that normally inhabit the intestinal tract are also permitted to send their products into the bloodstream, initiating another range of abnormal inflammatory and immune responses. Until a few years ago, celiac was believed to be rare, affecting only one per several thousand people. As the means to diagnose the disease have improved, the number of people with it has expanded to one per 133. Immediate relatives of people with celiac disease have a 4.5% likelihood of also developing it. Those with suggestive intestinal symptoms have as high as 17% likelihood. As we shall see, not only has more celiac disease been uncovered by better diagnostic testing, but the incidence of the disease itself has increased. Nonetheless, celiac disease is a well-kept secret. In the United States, 1 in 133 equates to just over 2 million people who have celiac disease, yet less than 10% of them know it. One of the reasons 1,800,000 Americans don't know they have celiac disease is that it is the great imitator, an honor previously bestowed on syphilis, expressing itself in so many varied ways. While 50% will experience the classic cramping, diarrhea, and weight loss over time, the other half show anemia, migraine headaches, arthritis, neurological symptoms, infertility, short stature in children, depression, chronic fatigue, or a variety of other symptoms and disorders that, at first glance, seem to have nothing to do with celiac disease. In others, it may cause no symptoms whatsoever, but shows up later in life as neurological impairment, incontinence, dementia, or gastrointestinal cancer. The ways that celiac disease shows itself are also changing. Until the mid-80s, children were usually diagnosed with symptoms of failure to thrive, weight loss, poor growth, diarrhea, and abdominal distension before age 2. More recently, children are more likely to be diagnosed because of anemia, chronic abdominal pain, or with no symptoms at all, and not until age 8 or older. In one large clinical study at the Stollery Children's Hospital in Edmonton, Alberta, the number of children diagnosed with celiac disease increased 11-fold from 1998 to 2007. Interestingly, 53% of children at the hospital who were diagnosed with antibody testing yet displayed no symptoms of celiac, nonetheless reported feeling better with gluten elimination. Parallel changes in celiac have been observed in adults, with fewer complaining of classic symptoms of diarrhea and abdominal pain, more being diagnosed with anemia, more complaining of skin rashes, such as dermatitis herpetiformis and allergies, and more showing no symptoms at all. Researchers have failed to agree on why celiac disease may have changed or why it is on the rise. The most popular theory currently, more mothers are breastfeeding. Yeah, I laughed too. Much of the changing face of celiac disease can certainly be attributed to earlier diagnosis, aided by the widely available antibody blood tests, but there also seems to be a fundamental change in the disease. Could the changing face of celiac disease be due to a change in wheat itself? It might cause dwarf wheat's developer, Dr. Norman Borlaug, to roll over in his grave, but there is data suggesting that something in wheat itself indeed changed sometime during the past 50 years. A fascinating study performed at the Mayo Clinic provides a unique snapshot of celiac incidence in U.S. residents from half a century ago, the closest we will come to having a time machine to answer our question. The researchers acquired blood samples drawn 50 years ago for a streptococcal infection study and kept frozen since. The frozen samples were collected during the period from 1948 to 1954 from more than 9,000 male recruits at Warren Air Force Base, WAFB, in Wyoming. After establishing the reliability of the long frozen samples, they tested them for celiac markers, transglutaminase and endomysium antibodies, and compared results to samples from two modern groups. A modern control group was chosen that consisted of 5,500 men with similar birth years to the military recruits, with samples obtained starting in 2006, mean age 70 years. A second modern control group consisted of 7,200 men of similar age, mean age 37 years, at the time of the blood draw of the Air Force recruits. While abnormal celiac antibody markers were identified in 0.2% of the WAFB recruits, 0.8% of men with similar birth ages, and 0.9% of modern young men had abnormal celiac markers. It suggests that the incidence of celiac increased fourfold since 1948 in men as they age, and has increased fourfold in modern young men. The incidence is likely to be even higher in females, since women outnumber men in celiac disease, but all the recruits enrolled in the original study were male. Recruits with positive celiac markers were also four times more likely to die, usually from cancer, over the 50 years since providing blood samples. I asked Dr. Joseph Murray, lead researcher in the study, if he expected to find the marked increase in the incidence of celiac disease. No, my initial assumption was that celiac disease was there all along and we just weren't finding it. While that was partly true, the data taught me otherwise. It really is increasing. Other studies showing that celiac disease occurs for the first time in elderly patients back up the imputation that something is affecting the population at any age, not just infant feeding patterns. A similarly constructed study was conducted by a group in Finland, part of a larger effort to chronicle health changes over time. Some 7,200 male and female Finns over age 30 provided blood samples for celiac markers from 1978 to 1980. 20 years later, in 2000 to 2001, another 6,700 male and female Finns, also over 30, provided blood samples. Measuring transglutaminase and endomysial antibody levels in both groups, the frequency of abnormal celiac markers increased from 1.05% in the earlier participants to 1.99%, a near doubling. We therefore have good evidence that the apparent increase in celiac disease, or at least the immune markers to gluten, is not just due to better testing. The disease itself has increased in frequency, fourfold over the past 50 years, doubling in just the past 20 years. To make matters worse, the increase in celiac disease has been paralleled by an increase in type 1 diabetes, autoimmune diseases such as multiple sclerosis and Crohn's disease, and allergies. Emerging evidence suggests that the greater exposure to gluten that now occurs with modern wheat may underlie at least part of the explanation for the increased incidence of celiac disease. A study from the Netherlands compared 36 modern strains of wheat with 50 strains representative of wheat grown up until a century ago. By looking for the gluten protein structures that trigger celiac, researchers found that celiac-triggering gluten proteins were expressed to higher levels in modern wheat, while non-celiac-triggering proteins were expressed less. In short, while celiac disease is usually diagnosed in people complaining of weight loss, diarrhea, and abdominal pain, in the 21st century you can be fat and constipated, or even thin and regular, and still have the disease. And you are more likely to have the disease than your grandparents were. While 20 to 50 years may be a long time in terms of wine or mortgages, it is far too little time for humans to have changed genetically. The timing of the two studies chronicling the increasing incidence of celiac antibodies, one in 1948 and the other in 1978, also parallel changes in the type of wheat that now populates most of the world's farms, namely dwarf wheat. Name that antibody. Three groups of antibody blood tests are now widely available to diagnose celiac disease, or at least strongly suggest that an immune response against gluten has been triggered. Antigliadin antibodies. The short-lived IgA antibody and the longer-lived IgG antigliadin antibodies are often used to screen people for celiac. While widely available, they are less likely to make the diagnosis in all people with the disease, failing to diagnose approximately 20 to 50% of true celiac sufferers. Transglutaminase antibody. Gluten damage to the intestinal lining uncovers muscle proteins that trigger antibody formation. Transglutaminase is one such protein. The antibody against this protein can be measured in the bloodstream and used to gauge the ongoing autoimmune response. Compared to intestinal biopsy, the transglutaminase antibody test identifies approximately 86 to 89% of celiac cases. Endomysium antibody. Like the transglutaminase antibody test, the endomysium antibody identifies another intestinal tissue protein that triggers an antibody response. Introduced in the mid-90s, this test is emerging as the most accurate antibody test, identifying more than 90% of celiac cases. If you have already divorced yourself from wheat, note that these tests can turn negative within a few months, and almost certainly negative or reduced after 6 months. So the tests have value only for people currently consuming wheat products, or only for those recently having stopped consuming wheat products. Fortunately, there are some other tests available. HLA-DQ2, HLA-DQ8. These are not antibodies, but genetic markers for human leukocyte antigens, or HLA, that, if present, make the bearer more likely to develop celiac disease. More than 90% of people who have celiac disease diagnosed by intestinal biopsy have either of these two HLA markers, most commonly the DQ2. A dilemma. 40% of the population have one of the HLA markers and or antibody markers that predispose them to celiac, yet express no symptoms or other evidence of an immune system gone awry. However, this latter group has been shown to experience better health when wheat gluten is eliminated. It means that a very substantial portion of the population is potentially sensitive to wheat gluten. Rectal challenge. Not a new TV game show, but a test involving the placement of a sample of gluten into the rectum to see whether an inflammatory response is triggered. While quite accurate, the logistical challenges of this 4-hour test limit its usefulness. Small intestine biopsy. Biopsy of the jejunum, the uppermost part of the small intestine, performed via an endoscope, is the gold standard by which all other tests are measured. The positive, the diagnosis can be made confidently. Negatives, an endoscopy and biopsies are required. Most gastroenterologists advise a small intestinal biopsy to confirm the diagnosis if suggestive symptoms such as chronic cramping and diarrhea are present, and antibody tests suggest celiac disease. However, some experts have argued, and I agree, that the increasing reliability of antibody tests, such as the endomysium antibody test, potentially make intestinal biopsy less necessary, perhaps unnecessary. Most celiac disease experts advocate starting with an endomysium and/or transglutaminase antibody test, followed by intestinal biopsy, if the antibody test is positive. In the occasional situation in which symptoms are highly suggestive of celiac disease, but antibody tests are negative, intestinal biopsy might still be considered. Conventional wisdom holds that if one or more antibody tests are abnormal, but intestinal biopsy is negative for celiac, then gluten elimination is not necessary. I believe this is dead wrong, since many of these so-called gluten-sensitive or latent celiac disease sufferers will either develop celiac disease over time or will develop some other manifestation of celiac disease, such as neurological impairment or rheumatoid arthritis. Another perspective. If you are committed to this notion of removing wheat from your diet, along with other sources of gluten, such as rye and barley, then testing may be unnecessary. The only time testing is a necessity is when serious symptoms or potential signs of wheat intolerance are present, and documentation would be useful to help eliminate the possibility of other causes. Knowing that you harbor the markers for celiac might also increase your resolve to be meticulously gluten-free. Zonulins, how wheat invites itself into the bloodstream. The gliadin protein of wheat gluten, present in all forms of wheat from spongy Wonder Bread to the coarsest organic multigrain loaf, has the unique ability to make your intestine permeable. Intestines are not meant to be freely permeable. You already know that the human intestinal tract is home to all manner of odd things, many of which you observe during your morning ritual on the toilet. The wondrous transformation of ham sandwich or pepperoni pizza into the components of your body, the remainder discarded, is truly fascinating. But the process needs to be tightly regulated, allowing entry of only selected components of ingested foods and liquids into the bloodstream. So what happens if various obnoxious compounds mistakenly gain entry into the bloodstream? One of the undesirable effects is autoimmunity. That is, the body's immune response is tricked into activation and attacks normal organs such as the thyroid gland or joint tissue. This can lead to autoimmune conditions such as Hashimoto's thyroiditis and rheumatoid arthritis. Regulating intestinal permeability is therefore a fundamental function of the cells lining the fragile intestinal wall. Recent research has fingered wheat gliadin as a trigger of intestinal release of a protein called zonulin, a regulator of intestinal permeability. Zonulins have the peculiar effect of disassembling tight junctions, the normally secure barrier between intestinal cells. When gliadin triggers zonulin release, intestinal tight junctions are disrupted, and unwanted proteins such as gliadin and other wheat protein fractions gain entry to the bloodstream. Immune-activating lymphocytes, such as T cells, are then triggered to begin an inflammatory process against various self-proteins, thus initiating wheat gluten and gliadin-initiated conditions, such as celiac disease, thyroid disease, joint diseases, and asthma. Gliadin wheat proteins are akin to being able to pick the lock on any door, allowing unwanted intruders to gain entry into places they don't belong. Outside of gliadin, few things share such a lock-picking, intestinal-disrupting talent. Other factors that trigger zonulin and disrupt intestinal permeability include the infectious agents that cause cholera and dysentery. The difference, of course, is that you contract cholera or amoebic dysentery by ingesting feces-contaminated food or water. You contract diseases of wheat by eating some nicely packaged pretzels or devil's food cupcakes. maybe you'll wish for diarrhea. After you read about some of the potential long-term effects of celiac disease, you just might find yourself wishing for diarrhea. Traditional notions of celiac disease revolve around the presence of diarrhea. No diarrhea, no celiac. Not true. Celiac disease is more than an intestinal condition with diarrhea. It can extend beyond the intestinal tract and show itself in many other varied ways. The range of diseases associated with celiac is truly astonishing, from childhood, type 1, diabetes, to dementia, to scleroderma. These associations are also among the least understood. It is therefore not clear whether anticipation of gluten sensitivity with removal of all gluten will, for instance, reduce or eliminate the development of childhood diabetes, certainly a tantalizing prospect. These conditions, like celiac disease, test positive for the various celiac antibody markers and are triggered by the immune and inflammatory phenomena set in motion by genetic predisposition, presence of the HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8 markers, and exposure to wheat gluten. One of the most bothersome aspects of the conditions associated with celiac disease is that intestinal symptoms of celiac may not be expressed. In other words, the celiac sufferer might have neurological impairment, such as loss of balance and dementia, yet be spared the characteristic cramping, diarrhea, and weight loss. Lack of telltale intestinal symptoms also means that the correct diagnosis is rarely made. Rather than calling it celiac disease without the intestinal expression of the condition, it would be more accurate to speak about immune-mediated gluten intolerance. But because these non-intestinal conditions of gluten sensitivity were first identified because they share the same HLA and immune markers with intestinal celiac disease, the convention is to speak about latent celiac disease, or celiac disease without intestinal involvement. I predict that as the medical world begins to better recognize that immune-mediated gluten intolerance is much more than celiac disease, we will be calling it something like immune-mediated gluten intolerance, of which celiac disease will be a subtype. Conditions associated with celiac disease, that is, immune-mediated gluten intolerance, include the following. Dermatitis herpetiformis. This characteristic rash is among the more common manifestations of celiac disease, or immune-mediated gluten intolerance. Dermatitis herpetiformis is an itchy, bumpy rash that usually occurs over the elbows, knees, or back. The rash disappears upon gluten removal. Liver disease. Liver diseases associated with celiac can assume many forms, from mild abnormalities on liver tests to chronic active hepatitis, to primary biliary cirrhosis, to biliary cancer. Like other forms of immune-mediated gluten intolerance, intestinal involvement and symptoms such as diarrhea are often not present, despite the fact that the liver is part of the gastrointestinal system. Autoimmune diseases. Diseases associated with immune attacks against various organs, known as autoimmune diseases, are more common in people with celiac. People with celiac disease are more likely to develop rheumatoid arthritis, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, connective tissue diseases such as lupus, asthma, inflammatory bowel diseases such as ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, as well as other inflammatory and immune disorders. Rheumatoid arthritis, a painful, disfiguring joint arthritis, treated with anti-inflammatory agents, has been shown to improve and occasionally remit entirely with gluten removal. The risk for autoimmune inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease is especially high. Incidence is 68-fold compared to non-celiacs. Insulin-dependent diabetes. Children with insulin-dependent type 1 diabetes have an unusually high likelihood of having positive antibody markers for celiac disease, with up to 20-fold greater risk for developing it. It is not clear whether wheat gluten is the cause of diabetes, but investigators have speculated that a subgroup of type 1 diabetics developed the disease triggered by gluten exposure. Neurological impairment. There are neurological conditions associated with gluten exposure that we will consider in greater detail later in the book. There is a curiously high incidence, 50%, of celiac markers among people who develop otherwise unexplained loss of balance and coordination, ataxia, or loss of feeling and muscle control in the legs, peripheral neuropathy. There is even a frightening condition called gluten encephalopathy, characterized by brain impairment with headaches, ataxia, and dementia, eventually fatal. Abnormalities are seen in the white matter of the brain by MRI. Nutritional deficiencies. Iron deficiency anemia is unusually common among celiac sufferers, affecting up to 69%. Deficiencies of vitamin B12, folic acid, zinc, and fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K are also common. Beyond those listed, there are literally hundreds of conditions that have been associated with celiac disease and or immune-mediated gluten intolerance, though less commonly. Gluten-mediated reactions have been documented to affect every organ in the human body, sparing none. Eyes, brain, sinuses, lungs, bones, you name it, gluten antibodies have been there. In short, the reach of gluten consumption consequences is mind-bogglingly wide. It can affect any organ at any age, showing itself in more ways than Tiger Woods had mistresses. Thinking of celiac disease as just diarrhea, as is often the case in many doctors' offices, is an enormous and potentially fatal oversimplification. Is it celiac disease or not? A true story. Let me tell you about Wendy. For more than 10 years, Wendy struggled unsuccessfully with ulcerative colitis. A 36-year-old grade school teacher and mother of three, she lived with constant cramping, diarrhea, and frequent bleeding, necessitating occasional blood transfusions. She endured several colonoscopies and required the use of 3 prescription medications to manage her disease, including the highly toxic methotrexate, a drug also used in cancer treatment and medical abortions. I met Wendy for an unrelated minor complaint of heart palpitations that proved to be benign, requiring no specific treatment. However, she told me that because her ulcerative colitis was failing to respond to medications, her gastroenterologist advised colon removal with creation of an ileostomy. This is an artificial orifice for the small intestine, ileum, at the abdominal surface, the sort to which you affix a bag to catch the continually emptying stool. After hearing Wendy's medical history, I urged her to try wheat elimination. "I really don't know if it's going to work," I told her, "but since you're facing colon removal and ileostomy, I think you should give it a try." "But why?" she asked. "I've already been tested for celiac, and my doctor said I don't have it." "Yes, I know, but you've got nothing to lose. Try it for 4 weeks. You'll know if you're responding." Wendy was skeptical, but agreed to try. She returned to my office 3 months later, no ileostomy bag in sight. "What happened?" I asked. "Well, first I lost 38 pounds. She ran her hand over her abdomen to show me. "And my ulcerative colitis is nearly gone. No more cramps or diarrhea. I'm off everything except my Acicol. Acicol is a derivative of aspirin, often used to treat ulcerative colitis. I really feel great." In the years since, Wendy has meticulously avoided wheat and gluten and has also eliminated the Acicol, with no return of symptoms. Cured. Yes, cured. No diarrhea, no bleeding, no cramps, no anemia, no more drugs, no ileostomy. So if Wendy's colitis tested negative for celiac antibodies, but responded to, indeed was cured by, wheat gluten elimination, what should we label it? Should we call it antibody-negative celiac disease? Antibody-negative wheat intolerance? There is a great hazard in trying to pigeonhole conditions such as Wendy's into something like celiac disease. It nearly caused her to lose her colon and suffer the lifelong health difficulties associated with colon removal, not to mention the embarrassment and inconvenience of wearing an ileostomy bag. There is not yet any neat name to fit conditions such as Wendy's, despite its extraordinary response to the elimination of wheat gluten. Wendy's experience highlights the many unknowns in this world of wheat sensitivities, many of which are as devastating as the cure is simple. Wheat and bungee jumping. Eating wheat, like ice climbing, mountain boarding, and bungee jumping, is an extreme sport. It is the only common food that carries its own long-term mortality rate. Some foods, such as shellfish and peanuts, have the potential to provoke acute allergic reactions, for example, hives or anaphylaxis, that can be dangerous in the susceptible, even fatal in rare instances. But wheat is the only common food that has its own measurable mortality rate when observed over years of consumption. In one large analysis over 8.8 years, there was up to 29.1% increased likelihood of death in people with celiac disease or who were antibody positive without celiac disease, compared to the broad population. The greatest mortality from wheat gluten exposure was observed in the 20-year-old and younger age group, followed by the 20 to 39 group. Mortality also increased across all age groups since 2000. Mortality in people with positive antibodies to wheat gluten, but without celiac, has more than doubled compared to mortality prior to 2000. Green peppers don't result in long-term mortality, nor do pumpkin, blueberries, or cheese. Only wheat. And you don't have to have symptoms of celiac disease for this to happen. Yet wheat is the food our own USDA encourages us to eat. I personally don't believe that it would be a stretch for the FDA, which now regulates tobacco, to require a warning on wheat-containing products, much as they require for cigarettes. Imagine. Surgeon General's warning. Wheat consumption in all forms poses potentially serious threats to health. In June 2010, the FDA passed a regulation requiring tobacco manufacturers to remove the deceptive light, mild, and low descriptors from cigarette packages, since they are all every bit as bad as any other cigarette. Wouldn't it be interesting to see similar regulation highlighting that wheat is wheat, regardless of whole grain, multigrain, or high fiber? Our friends across the Atlantic published an extraordinary analysis of 8 million residents of the United Kingdom, identifying more than 4,700 people with celiac disease, and comparing them to 5 control subjects for every celiac participant. All participants were then observed for 3.5 years for the appearance of various cancers. Over the observation period, participants with celiac disease showed 30% greater likelihood of developing some form of cancer, with an incredible 1 of every 33 celiac participants developing cancer despite the relatively short period of observation. Most of the cancers were gastrointestinal malignancies. Observation of more than 12,000 Swedish celiac sufferers showed a similar 30% increased risk for gastrointestinal cancers. The large number of participants revealed the broad variety of gastrointestinal cancers that can develop, including malignant small intestinal lymphomas and cancers of the throat, esophagus, large intestine, hepatobiliary system, liver and bile ducts, and pancreas. Over a period of up to 30 years, the investigators tabulated a doubling of mortality compared to Swedes without celiac disease. You'll recall that latent celiac disease means having one or more positive antibody tests for the disease, but without evidence of intestinal inflammation, observed via endoscopy and biopsy, what I call immune-mediated gluten intolerance. Observation of 29,000 people with celiac disease over approximately 8 years showed that, of those with latent celiac disease, there was 30 to 49% increased risk for fatal cancers, cardiovascular disease, and respiratory diseases. It may be latent, but it ain't dead. It's very much alive. If celiac disease or immune-mediated gluten intolerance goes undiagnosed, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma of the small intestine can result, a difficult-to-treat and often fatal condition. Celiac sufferers are exposed to as much as 40-fold increased risk for this cancer compared to non-celiacs. Risk reverts to normal after 5 years of gluten removal. Celiac sufferers who fail to avoid gluten can experience as much as 77-fold increased risk for lymphoma and 22-fold greater risk for cancers of the mouth, throat, and esophagus. Let's think about this. Wheat causes celiac disease and or immune-mediated gluten intolerance, which is underdiagnosed by an incredibly large margin, since only 10% of celiac sufferers know they have the disease. That leaves the remaining 90% ignorant. Cancer is a not uncommon result. Yes, indeed, wheat causes cancer, and it often causes cancer in the unsuspecting. At least when you bungee jump off a bridge and hang at the end of a 200-foot cord, you know that you're doing something stupid. But eating healthy whole grains, who would guess that it makes bungee jumping look like hopscotch? Don't eat communion wafers with lipstick on. Even knowing the painful and potentially severe consequences of eating gluten foods, celiac sufferers struggle to avoid wheat products, although it seems like an easy thing to do. Wheat has become ubiquitous, often added to processed foods, prescription drugs, even cosmetics. Wheat has become the rule, not the exception. Try to eat breakfast and you discover that breakfast foods are a minefield of wheat exposure. pancakes, waffles, French toast, cereal, English muffins, bagels, toast. What's left? Look for a snack. You'll be hard-pressed to find anything without wheat. Certainly not pretzels, crackers, or cookies. Take a new drug, and you may experience diarrhea and cramping from the tiny quantity of wheat.